This is something, you know, bold and visionary. I want people to be able to start new countries. I want people to start a bunch of new countries around a bunch of different concepts of the good life so we can see what works, and have them, some of them eventually work so well that the mainstream countries are like, well, we got to try that.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Patry Friedman. Patry founded the Seasteading Institute, a nonprofit exploring the creation of sovereign ocean colonies. He is on the board of the Startup Societies Foundation, advising a variety of new governance projects. And most recently, he founded Pronomos, the first charter city investment fund. Patry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A lot of your work seems to be focused on the idea of reimagining cities, and I thought maybe we could start off, you could tell me a little bit about where you grew up, where you're originally from, Patry.
Sure, yeah. I grew up mainly in the Philadelphia area on the East Coast, and then when I turned 18, I went off to California for college and stayed there for almost 30 years until I moved to Austin a couple years ago.
I am curious, I did a bit of research, and it seems like the place you did grow up is a bit of a small town, because I'm from a small town in New Zealand, and I just wondered, like, your first encounter with a city of scale, like, tell me about what that meant for you.
Yeah, my town was mainly famous for its mall. That's what, like, people from the Philly area have heard of it for, you know, and...
Come on, man. My town, we have like one place with an escalator. That was like the big thing at the time. So I think I understand where you're coming from, right? So you came from a small town. I mean, did that change your outlook, though, on sort of what's possible with cities and what cities actually mean as a place?
Yeah. For me, I think it's like, it's less about something about the city. And it's more that, like, it just seems like the right unit to work with. You know, my passion is for trying to help us upgrade our governance and make governments that work better and preserve freedom better, and let people prosper. And just feels like it's, you know, like if we can start a sovereign city state in 10 years, I would be ecstatic. Starting something even bigger than that, like a country, which is like more than a city, like, I mean, a sovereign city state is already so big, and then that's like even more. It doesn't make sense. And like for units like smaller than the city, you know, I want to have impact on the world. I want to help millions of people get better jobs. And, you know, a 10,000 person town is not going to do that. The impact is limited. You know, I want to make Singapore's and Hong Kong. So like, I feel like the city is just like this like economic unit, and it just has felt for a while like the right size to work at.
Yeah. Well, I think pulling on that thread, I mean, throughout history, we do have this lineage of great cities. And you got places like Athens, Rome, Jerusalem, the Italian city-states, in history. And then obviously today, places like New York or Tokyo, these places that have an energy to them, and there's like a scale of economy. There's all these things that go into a city. But you're right that, at least in the ancient sense, historically, you know, the eternal city, somewhere like Rome, had a profound impact on the world. And so there is like an economic power, or sort of a, even more than economics, there's something about that, a gravitational pull, right, of cities.
Yeah, it's like, it's just like the right-sized organism.
The right-sized organism. That's interesting. It's like environmental logic, right? Like because they do come in different sizes, because even in ancient times, I mean, Rome wasn't that big, you know, maybe a couple hundred thousand people. And yet here I am myself an hour south of Tokyo, which is maybe 20 or 30 million people, depending on the time of day. So you've got this range of sizes. And so, I mean, what are your thoughts on that role of like the scale and actual population size of cities?
I mean, I think if it works, the goal is to make things like Singapore or Hong Kong. I don't know if we'll be able to do that. And, you know, it really depends on the time scale you're looking on. You know, we're talking about compound growth. And so the difference in size at 20 years and 50 years is going to be really different. You know, and our job is to, you know, make sure that they succeed, that they're great places to live, that draw people in and grow faster than, you know, the majority of the world, which has not been zoned into good governance.
It's not been zoned into good governance. That's interesting. You know, this idea of zoning even, at a, you know, what you can even do with a plot of land is quite an interesting question here in Japan. Have you ever been to Japan, Patri?
Yeah, I've been to Tokyo a few times. I haven't been anywhere else.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation where you can have like light industrial, you can have residential, you can have all sorts of stuff sort of together, and you get this density, which is quite different to somewhere like New Zealand where I'm from, where it's you know, kind of suburbia in a lot of cases. It's sort of spread out, and you don't get that density, right? But pulling on this this thread of cities, I'm keen to just trace a lineage of your work. And obviously, you've probably talked about this a million times, but and certainly your early work looking at seasteading, it seemed like some of those ideas have fed into your later work. But maybe if we just start there with that place and sort of what seasteading, sort of where that came from and what that meant for you at the time.
Sure. I mean, you know, seasteading was kind of like was a tool. And the real goal is to make it so that people can try out different systems of laws, different constitutions, different bodies of regulation. You know, the way I look at it is that like innovation, which is like figuring out how to do things in new ways, requires experimentation. Like we don't know if it, we don't know what's going to work when we haven't tried it yet. And so in order to, you know, and we have startups all the time inventing new software and building new kinds of cars and, you know, and all this stuff. But like there's not a way for like a team of people with passion and idea and some funding to try out a new system of government. And so that means that you don't, you know, whether you want to think of it of like a scientific metaphor of R&D and experiments or a startup metaphor of these as being startups to try, you know, clean slate rewrites of things of value. You know, either way, like we need the experiments, we need the startup sector. And so I was like, well, how do we do this? You know, all land is claimed. And back when I started this work in the early 2000s, countries weren't open to the kinds of deals that we're making with them now. And so I looked at the ocean, you know, both because it's the next frontier and, you know, it's open, but also like the legal structure is very different. Like some people hear about my work and assume it's like, oh, on the high seas, you can do anything, which is not at all true. It's the way that it works is that every ship has to register with a country and fly their flag. And then when that ship is out past 12 nautical miles, it is governed by the laws of the flag country. It's like a way of franchising sovereignty. There are some additional rules basically about like who owns the oil, basically, you know, that says that the closest country gets all the resources out to like 200 miles. But you know, for whatever's happening, you know, on board the ship. And so this system, and it's like you can choose any country in the world and you can change it. So it's actually a competitive system with relatively low switching costs. And like, I mean, I kind of feel like if this was the way we structured, if like towns could like choose their counties and counties could choose their provinces and provinces could choose their countries, like I'd be done. You know, we'd be able to have competition and experimentation and learn better ways to live together. So it's actually this great legal structure. But at the same time, it's partnered with, like, the reason for that legal structure is that the ocean is, like, physically different and things move around different parts of the world all the time. And it makes it, you know, very difficult to build things there. And so it was kind of like back in the 2000s, you know, I worked on it for 10 years, it kind of like looked like the best approach. But ultimately, when countries started being willing to do these experiments on land, starting with Honduras in 2011, although it took them most, you know, took them 5+ years to get the program running, I switched to doing that. I feel like we're making a lot of progress with places like Prospera and Alpha Cities and our other companies. So yes, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, I understand. And look, man, I guess on the creative lens of this, I'm really interested in kind of where these kind of conversations came from. I saw a really good documentary a few years ago called Spaceship Earth, which was looking at, I think it was called Biosphere 2, which was this like self-enclosed, you're probably Yeah, pretty familiar with it. And I mean, it was pretty trippy. It was like kind of born out of this hippie movement, this idea that we could sort of build a new community that's totally hermetically sealed from the rest of Earth. And it had some interesting outcomes. I mean, there were some challenges. It didn't quite work as planned in some ways, but it also was a success. I think it was like a year or two they ended up living in this dome. And we see concepts like this, Buckminster Fuller and others have explored, you know, what it means to kind of exit in a creative sense. And I'm just wondering, did some of these ideas feed into your thinking kind of on the creative side?
Yeah, I mean, definitely after I kind of researched things and, you know, had my own insights about thinking about law like software and thinking about governments like businesses and citizens as their customers. You know, I did a lot of research. I looked at, Buckminster Fuller's Triton City. And I just think, you know, this is a tension that comes up a lot in this space between, I call it like the dreamers and the doers, where like, this is something, you know, bold and visionary. I want people to be able to start new countries. I want people to start a bunch of new countries around a bunch of different concepts of the good life so we can see what works, and have them, some of them eventually work so well that the mainstream countries are like, well, we got to try that, you know, and impact humanity. So it's a huge, crazy vision. I mean, people tell me sometimes when I tell them about Pronomos, my fund, that it's like the craziest fund that they've ever heard of, even in all the crazy stuff in Silicon Valley. You know, at the same time, the reason I'm doing this, I mean, I guess it's fun along the way to pitch big ideas. I like that, certainly. But like, I want to work on things that turn into reality. And so I find myself in this space where like I'm reading and learning about a lot of people who had all kinds of ideas. You know, the Millennial Project by Marshall Savage, I think, was like proposing these huge floating OTEC powered cities. And like, you know, I end up being around that stuff and being compared to it. And at the same time, I feel like I have like a profoundly different attitude as far as like the pragmatism of like, no, I actually want to get there. And I think that a lot of these, they're thought pieces. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with thought pieces. Like, there's nothing wrong with science fiction. But I guess I've kind of developed some strong opinions along the way about the differences between like thought pieces and the kind of like the mindset that they're written in, and like what it takes to actually build something really new and difficult in the real world.
I think I understand the praxis of doing the thing and actually, you know, making it happen is quite profound. And people can live in an intellectual bubble. It's the world, the realm of ideas, right? But to actually go in, and I think you talk about the beauty of dirt in one of your talks, or the profoundness of like seeing a piece of dirt that's like actually sovereign.
Dirt. Yeah. After you show people renderings of ocean cities, you know, for 10 years or whatever, and then renderings of future cities for another 10 years, and it's like, wait, look, there's something real. This is the goal. And actually, you know, another one of our companies just let me know today that they've got a lead investor for enough funding to build their first, you know, campus, you know, their first like in-person development. I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited. I want to fly to Africa and, you know, I want to see when it opens, like tangible.
What I think is interesting, though, pulling on that thread, and I'm really interested in hearing your perspective on this, but there seems to be a connection with startup culture and basically the, you know, startup style, San Francisco style startup culture, which is to build things, iterate quickly, fail fast, these kinds of ideas, right? And that when that comes to state building, though, and sovereignty, maybe that's the piece that people get a bit funny about. You know, this isn't just a business you can fail and then go on your way. If it is actually a state, there's all sorts of questions that we necessarily must confront. What does it mean to be a refugee from a failed state? What, you know, et cetera. So what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, this is the advantage of the charter city approach, is that the long-term goal is to start sovereign countries, but we're not ready yet. And the way a charter city works, you can think of like, it's a bit like Hong Kong. The Hong Kong was more like an overseas territory where, you know, it's part of the British Empire, but it had its own laws, its own government, its own courts. You know, or another example would be Dubai's financial center, which, you know, is run by the government, but which where they took an both a physical area and it's an incorporation jurisdiction, and brought and made completely different new laws for it, based on London's financial regulations in English, you know, where the previous laws, you know, were like Sharia influenced and in Arabic. And they said this area of the country and all companies who incorporate there are under this different legal code. And so it, in a charter city, the host country passes legislation to enable the creation of a new type of special economic zone. And then forms a public-private partnership with a company, although it doesn't have to. Like in Dubai, they ran their own. But yeah, so the projects that I'm working on are generally done by a private company, you know, that we invest in, that partners with the government, just like any other PPP, to develop a city and have significant autonomy over what the regulations are there. So government designates a piece of land, they have different laws than the rest of the country. And so it, you know, if it fails, like they're still part of their same country. There's no need to be a refugee. You know, we would wind things down, you know, properly, and they would transition back to what they have right now.
Understood. Well,
but long term, well, you're going to have to believe in it to want to go join the first sovereign startup city state.
The reason I bring that up, I was actually just in Hong Kong the other month, and, you know, this idea of law as code, I think in one of your talks you talk about forking London's code for Dubai, mm-hmm. and how that happened. And yeah. I mean, I think this is really interesting. You know, I'm obviously really interested in these ideas, but at the same time, it seems to perhaps overlook the importance of the spirit of the law and the fact that in Hong Kong, that project has failed, right? The Communist Party of China has taken over, and we're seeing the failure, law. Okay.
I totally disagree. I think, I mean, first off, Hong Kong has kept significant economic freedom. But second, like, there was a lease and it ended. Like, the proper thing is for it to be run by this other country, and everybody knew the whole time that China was going to take it back. Like, that was the deal. And I guess I'm in the business now of making these kinds of deals. And so I'm like, you got to follow the deal. That's like, that's first principles. And I would say that, you know, I mean, existing at now, like on the political freedom side, sure, like Hong Kong is no longer a bastion of political freedom, you know, for in the region and for Chinese people, like for sure. But on the, I guess that's the best way to differentiate it. Whereas like on the, but it had a lot of influence. I'm sure it fostered lots of sentiment about changes in China, you know, over those many decades. But from an economic perspective, you know, I think there's a lot of connection between the existence of Hong Kong and the creation of Shenzhen and all the other zones, which lifted more people out of poverty, 500 million people, than has ever happened before in the entire world, because they had this, you know, not just example of a charter city, but like tons of Chinese people made lots of money and learned business and got really good at it. And there was like the culture of business and entrepreneurship was able to like flourish for those people. And then, you know, when Deng started like liberalizing, there was, you know, plenty of talent and business experience to change the trajectory of the whole country. So I feel like it succeeded. And I, you know, I would love to have, you know, 1% of that much of the impact that Hong Kong had in uplifting people would be pretty sick.
Yeah, understood. Well, there's kind of two situations there, right? Because Shenzhen was its own kind of mini, charter cities might not the right word, but Shenzhen had its own policies that liberalized a lot of the entrepreneurship there, as you mentioned, under Deng Xiaoping, within the context of China. But coming back to Hong Kong, you mentioned, you know, clearly there has been decline in the political freedoms. And this it loops back, though, to the economic freedoms, because people are thinking, well, hey, can we domicile a business in Hong Kong if our chairperson says the wrong thing? He's going to get hauled off to jail. And I mean, I know, look, you know, this is a complex space to be working in, but I mean, we must look at this, right? And
I'm not saying that like Hong Kong is now an equally good jurisdiction at all. I'm just saying it's had insane impact already.
And I think what the thread I want to pull on, and look, you know, we're trying to just analyze this to come to truth together. But with with the case of Hong Kong, it reminds me of many other situations in the past where a hegemon, a powerful country, and it could be anyone from the British Empire through to the Communist Party of China, someone can come in and kind of overwrite whatever is going on because they feel like it. And I see
it's theirs. When the lease expired, it was theirs. I mean, in the same way that the CCP can override whatever happens in Shanghai whenever they feel like it. Yep, like that's what it means to be a sovereign.
I must comment on that though. I mean, the lease expired, but the provision was that you would maintain Hong Kong basic law throughout the period. No, they haven't. I mean, Hong Kong no longer has its fundamental situation that it had in 1997. And I guess that's what I'm getting at, man. Like, just clearly,
I didn't know that they weren't sticking to that part of the deal. Yeah, that's not right.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of Hong Kongers, and I mean, I've interviewed plenty of people about this, like, they're pretty upset that the freedoms that they knew in the 90s, because the Hong Kong, I don't know about you, man, but the Hong Kong I grew up thinking about, you know, in little old New Zealand, was this kind of cool happening place. It was Jackie Chan.
Oh, yeah.
It was all the
business. I love it, man. It's like high rises and street markets.
Yeah. But that Hong Kong now is, you know, you can't sell a book about Xi Jinping without getting hauled off to jail. You know, there's a chilling effect. And I mean, I know people working in businesses who are like, well, we can't domicile there. And it's a boon for somewhere like Singapore. I mean, this is your competitive cities kind of playing out, but who would want to have a bank in Hong Kong?
If you wouldn't want to domicile in China, then I would be very leery of domiciling in Hong Kong these days.
And I guess this is what I'm getting at, man. Because I'm very passionate about these ideas that you're exploring. But the other example that comes to mind, just coming back to New Zealand. Have you ever been to New Zealand, by the way? Or
I have not. I haven't been to New Zealand. No.
I do hope you get the chance to come sometime. But back in the 19th century, obviously New Zealand was a colonial project. And I've been reading this incredible book on a self-sovereign community that was developed by the Maori people of New Zealand from the 1860s to the 1880s. It was a place called Parihaka. And it never ceded sovereignty. They didn't want to be part of the British Empire. They didn't want to become part of that. They just wanted to do their own thing. And there was the British came in and it's kind of like, and it was peaceful resistance as well. They didn't fight back. But where I want to take this with you, Patri, is this idea of, you know, law as code and startup cities, da, 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 you know, that's all nice and good until the tanks roll in and the bayonets come out. And I just wonder if you have a philosophy or sort of approach to how that works.
Yeah, I mean, I think the risk of getting invaded by a powerful country is definitely not high on my list of concerns. And I think if you look at how things went down in Honduras, I think it's a much better example of the reality. So, you know, for those who don't know, Honduras created the first charter city program in the world starting in 2011. I worked with them for a year or two back then. But it being a, you know, like a small country without great state capacity trying to do something really new was hard. And it took them probably 6-7 years to actually launch the program. And a company called Honduras Prospera worked with them, helped finish the program, and became the first registered zone under it, where they get to write all their own commercial law. And, you know, a couple of years after they launched, there was an election where the party that had been ruling the country since 2009, had been winning the elections, lost in a landslide. The program itself was totally clean. I mean, it didn't even have any budget for many years. It was like a nights and weekends Google 20% project for the regulators, which I think is hilarious. You know, it's their passion project. You know, but that government and the president were corrupt. And in fact, the U.S. was waiting to arrest him until he left office, because I guess the U.S. doesn't arrest sitting heads of state. And he lost the election and is in a U.S. jail. And the person who won, Xiomara Castro, who's the wife of this guy, Zelaya, who like tried to abolish term limits and the military kicked him out in 2009. I would describe her as a Marxist in the sense that she like unrecognized Taiwan, cozied up to China, restored relations with Venezuela. Like, I don't mean a Marxist, like I'm a libertarian and she's to the left of me. I mean, like, that's clearly her jam and her world. And she hated the program, you know, because there's a sense in which it's like capitalism and innovation, value creation is kind of anathema to that worldview. And she had a campaign promise to shut the program down. And she was elected. She hired someone whose like full-time job it was to work against the zones. And they weren't able to do it because the program was put in the Honduran constitution and Honduran law. And, you know, eventually they were able to, when enough Supreme Court judges, they'd gotten to a point, they got a Supreme Court ruling against it. But, you know, I should explain what the, well, you'll see what the enforcement mechanism is, because you don't, it doesn't depend on the country itself. And so, like, they weren't able to. And, you know, like, a military attack on this, you know, hotel resort and, you know, house factory, et cetera, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So they weren't able to shut it down. And the enforcement mechanism, it's one of the, like, the very few times in the world where, like, the way things work is kind of like maybe how, like, an economist would design them. So the way it works is it's effectively like all of a country's assets that are held outside that country, whether that's a bank account, you know, somewhere, or their state-owned enterprises, property, like any kind of assets, is kind of like a bond that they've posted that they will stick to their agreements. And so the way it works is that, you know, if Honduras was like, you have to shut down, and they would never return, like, they just ghosted all the requests where, you know, where there's like legal letters being like, hey, do you mean this? Are you saying we have to shut down? Or is it just like rhetoric? And they would never answer any of them. Because if they say like, no, we didn't mean it, that's like betraying their campaign promise. And if they say like, yes, you have to shut down, that's like immediate grounds for action against them and injunctions and like, and all of that. So they just didn't answer. And eventually, you know, Prospera sued them. So you sue an international arbitration. There are these big dispute resolution networks that, you know, most countries are part of. And if you win, you can take that award to most of the countries in the world, 130, most countries, and you can just take anything that country has up to the value of the award. So you can take from their bank accounts. If there's people like paying their state-owned enterprises, you can like garnish that and make them like pay, like you buy the oil from them, but the money goes to me. And so you're not depending on the country's legal system at all. And so something like them, you know, appointing some friendly Supreme Court justices and having a totally nonsense ruling that like goes against like 40 precedents, like, because they tried to rule that the program was not just like not valid, like we got to stop approving new ones, but they said it was like never valid, it was invalid from the beginning. And the Honduran Constitution actually says you can't retroactively say that things were invalid from before, and this has been upheld like 40 times. So it's like a total mm-hmm. nonsense ruling, but you're not depending on it. And so like, sure, can a government with significant military power like come in and, you know, like take the factories or attack you, like, sure, but, you know, their mechanism to prevent this. And these mechanisms obviously were not in any way invented for or by us. This is literally the way that all cross-border investment in the world is protected. Every time a country makes a partnership to go, you know, mine resources or build a factory or whatever, they're all depending on this same system. And last on this, there's a funny story about it, which I love, which is that, like, so Honduras was like, these investor dispute resolution networks, they always rule for the companies against the countries, they're no good, they're biased. And so they withdrew from ICSID, the largest one, which doesn't retroactively get them out of a lawsuit or anything. Obviously, you wouldn't allow that. So they withdrew. And meanwhile, they're cozying up to China. They stop recognizing Taiwan, and China, of course, is going to like Belt and Road style, throw a few hundred million to start into some infrastructure or loans or something. And China said, hey, Honduras, we can't give you this money if you're not in an investor state dispute resolution network. Like, even their new commie, it's like, this is the glue to all, like, international commerce. And so even the CCP was like, you got to be in one of these networks. It doesn't have to be that one. You can pick one of its competitors. But, like, so.
Okay. That's interesting. So there's this global network of international organizations that can help facilitate this international law, international trade, and can punish.
And there's, like, just treaties involved. You know, Honduras has investor treaties with the U.S. and Kuwait, which tie them into this system.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the thought experiment, I mean, I appreciate this is in the abstract realm, but I also wonder what happens when you start getting conflicting interpretations of truth. And we do see this sometimes with little islands in the Pacific, you know, someone claiming this island or that island.
That's what the arbitrator's for.
Larger islands as well. So, yeah, talk to me about this. Yeah, arbitration.
Also, another thing on this threat model is that a guy I know started a community in South America, libertarians, you know, I don't know, maybe a few dozen families. They were in a rural area when the pandemic happened, and the country they were in didn't do so great. Law and order went to crap, and they found themselves, like, defending their community with firearms from people come to pillage and rape. And it's that kind of thing, you know, makes it very real. You know, I'm not saying that that kind of thing doesn't happen, and governments are very, they're very into violence, but it's just, it doesn't really seem like the way the 21st century is mainly structured, with countries resolving their disputes that way. And we're not trying to be like the enemies of some country, right? I mean, the host country is like our key partner, although, as in the case of Honduras, elections happen and things turn south, and that's when you use your defenses. But I think obviously I would encourage people to be able to defend themselves. I'm not like a, like, I don't know, my boys wouldn't go down in peaceful protest. But I just think it's not the main enforcement or defense mechanism for the 21st
century. I appreciate this is getting into some history and stuff, but this what's really interesting to me is, again, I think this is an incredible approach or philosophy towards doing stuff, and obviously you are doing stuff in this space, but I look at New Zealand during the pandemic, and I was quite critical of the government, and I thought that they fucked it up and that they shouldn't have done what they did and locked us down. And I was protesting, and then they brought the police in and they bashed everyone over the head. And I got away, but it was like, okay, what do you do in that situation? Or if you're in Hong Kong and saying, hey guys, you know, my basic law has been violated. I don't agree with this. I'm going to exercise my right for peaceful protest, blah, blah, blah. And then the police come in and tear gas you. And there's kind of like, well, do you shoot back? And what happened? A lot of people don't even have guns anymore. And so, you know, they're kind of, it comes back to law of the jungle. Yeah. And the police always have the monopoly on violence, you know, the state. And it's kind of, yeah. I don't know, man. Thought piece. Yeah.
Police don't have a monopoly on violence in the sense
state.
You know, yeah. I own a firearm, but but the state does have a massive amount of military power, and you know, shooting back is romantic. But again, I don't think that's the way that you battle governments in the 21st century. You know, I'm all about building better alternatives, exit to better systems, go rebuild, find the like-minded people who see things your way, form communities together.
Yeah. Okay, so pulling on that through then, because, I mean, that's cool. I mean, that's exciting, right? It sort of represents a turning of the corner. We don't have to go out onto the streets and pick up the brick and throw the thing. You know, it's actually an economic process.
Exit and build.
Okay, so look, let's talk about that, because, I mean, this seems to be pulling from this kind of San Francisco business culture, startup culture, and it's exciting. Like, what's possible with that? And so pushing the limits of what's possible, the economic engine of these charter cities, I mean, what do you see? Is it intellectual in terms of building software, things like that? I mean, is it manufacturing? Because, I mean, economies generally are quite mixed, right? Yeah, farming, industry, all sorts of things.
For sure.
In a charter city, what can it do? Where's its economic engine?
Yeah, I mean, it's like asking what a city's economic engine is, right? And it depends on the city. So, for example, our kind of fastest growing company, Alva Cities, is working with like 8 countries in Africa, you know, close to getting our first land grants. And so for that, it's like in each country that we're looking at, it's kind of like you go into McKinsey mode a little bit, right? Like, what are their resources? Like, what is untapped? What are the skills that people have? Like, what industries would make sense here? And I think that at the beginning, you know, one mistake that I think has been made in the space, I made myself for a long time, is this idea of like better government, you have higher compounded GDP growth rates, right? And over time, this ends up mattering a lot. And so I think that like freedom, economic freedom, political freedom is like a really powerful accelerant for the engine. But I think what people miss is that at the beginning, you have no engine. You can't accelerate it. You have to like build it. And so we're expecting that like with Alpha City, we'll have to either be like forming the key partnerships or, you know, finding great anchor tenants, or in a lot of cases, starting them ourselves, so that like to create the initial economic engine that starts making jobs. And then you can have all kinds, you know, then you need your dentists and you need your coffee shop and all of that. But yeah, it's a customized plan, you know, based on the country and the location. And as far as, you know, I can give some examples. For example, we're looking at AI data centers and there's some places in Africa that have massive amounts of untapped renewable energy, just insane amounts of geothermal. And like AI data centers is like the great way to monetize that. If you have cheap power, you know, put up data centers. And another is manufacturing electric vehicles on continent. So, you know, right now it's like, and there's generally like, I think a general model that we're looking at is it's like vertical integration or like onshoring later stage processing. So just think of the difference between like mining lithium and then like sending it to China or the US, and then it gets made into a lithium battery to power an electric vehicle. And then also the drivetrain gets manufactured. So you put it all together versus like you make the batteries and then you ship out the battery, which is now a higher value, like further in the chain. You know, or like the difference between, you know, growing cacao and like coffee bar, right? The cacao is like 5% of the value of that chocolate bar. Mm-hmm. And so like keeping more value in country by doing the later steps of the processing there, that's the closest thing to like a general formula that we're finding. But yeah, each country is different. What resources do they have?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, we're sort of diving into, you know, development studies here where we're actually looking at, you know, how do you build up an economy? And I recently interviewed a guy, Joe Studwell, who did a lot of work looking at African development and the different kind of modes of African development. And you have places like Angola, which are kind of these extractive, basically an oil company will come in, have like five dudes extracting billions of dollars of oil, and then you've got the villages on the outside. And then you've got other parts of Africa that are maybe a little bit more integrated and moving forward with kind of cities that actually have mixed economies that are not just one thing. And there are challenges there because we're talking about a city here, which necessarily is a cosmopolitan thing. And when you're looking at resource extraction, I mean, it is a one-way process and you don't even really need a city for it. You just need a rig, right? And so how do you balance that kind of cosmopolitan mixed economy with we're going to extract the thing and mine the lithium? Like, how do you sort of go from one to the other?
Well, think about the difference between these models of like, you mine the lithium, you send it off. You mine the lithium, you make the batteries, you manufacture drivetrains, you manufacture the motors, right? And then you put together the EV. I mean, it's a lot more different industries and a lot more jobs, right? Versus like five dudes keeping a rig running. Yeah. And so, you know, I think Angola would be a great candidate for that because they're doing so much extraction, I think that they're interested in trying out some of these new things. I mean, I do think of it as like 21st century version of international development, where 20th century was like aid and NGOs, and like it didn't work that well.
Well, I think that the interesting piece is that the economic reality is that they can't manufacture batteries in Angola because there's not the scales of economy, there's none of the infrastructure, right? And so there's this role necessarily of the state. And this is where we get back into like butting up against perhaps what I would like to believe is that we can minimize the state. But you do need a strong state in these places to come in. And we've seen this in places like Rwanda with Paul Kagame, who's like, all right, we're going to be the Singapore of Central Africa. Mm-hmm. And he's the strong man and he's coming in and he's trying to push that. But there's...
Yeah, it's been very successful at influencing Rwanda. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's sort of been able to have a vision, right? And then we come back to being, well, basically we're just having normal countries. You know, these are not startup states anymore. These are like normal countries. And I don't know, man, it's sort of like, do we end up like going through this whole process and then we end up back at like, you know, nation states as they are currently? I don't know.
I mean, you know, we're talking about like, we're talking about a for-profit company like providing like governance and like body the regulation and courts, like the whole incentive structure. I mean, get back to a nation state as far as like there's a clearly defined entity who is like has control over or is the point of contact for a fixed like geographic territory. Like, sure, that could happen. I think we're going to move away from that with network state stuff, but it may take a while, and there probably will be some of that territorial nation state like left. But if, you know, if instead of it being like, you know, whatever strong man can grab power or whoever can be popular enough to win an election, it's like, well, there's shareholders and a board of directors and an executive team, and it's their job to make things happen. And they can have like performance incentives based on like things like GDP or citizen satisfaction in a way where like right now, if you're in a state and you do something that like slashes the country's GDP by 10%, like if people realize it, you might be unpopular, but like you still are going to have your job for a while. Mm. Versus like, hey, like my annual bonus depends on the impact that I managed to have on this economy. I think it'll be really different, but
yeah,
I guess we'll see. Well, I hope to get a chance to find out.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's interesting. I guess what that necessarily leads into, though, as a thought experiment again, in reality perhaps, is the question of money, Patry. Mm-hmm. And we look at the, what are the fundamental roles of the state? And one of them is, you know, love it or hate it, central banking and provision of currency. And I'm keen to understand what your thoughts are with these charter cities and this innovation space moving forward. Like, how can money work? You know, obviously I'm very interested in Bitcoin. How do you see that playing into the picture here?
Yeah, look, you know, just when the government is a business, it's trying to, you know, if it's collecting income tax, say, then its revenue is like, say you charge 10%, it's like 10% of GDP. Then it wants to create a great product to attract people. And I think, you know, the way that we would look at money is like, what are people using? What do they want to use? How can we provide them options that we like? And so again, you know, it's to me, it's like, it's not philosophical. I know for a lot of, I mean, money can be, but like currencies in a charter city to me is kind of like purely pragmatic. Like, of course, like we're going to support like stable coins and Bitcoin, you know, and give people options. You're like, at least that's how we're thinking at Alpha Cities. Like at the same time, there's this general, like people always ask me for like that type of question. And it's like, well, which charter city? Like, I don't control them. They're going to create different products. They're going to make different feature choices. And currency is one of those feature choices. So different ones might do it really differently. Maybe it'll be all crypto. Maybe it'll be no crypto. But for the projects that I'm more directly involved in, yeah, we just, I mean, you know, Africa's had some insane growth from like payment processor companies, and like it's still like there's a lot of issues with the financial system there. And I think there's a lot that can be done. Yeah, again, like even something as simple as like stable coins and make it just easy for people to like bank and transact in like USDC or whatever. I think would be a big win, but you have to look at what people want, right? And another, like, I feel like Prosper kind of tried to build like for libertarians, and what they've seen is it's really hard to get, you know, and a lot of these products are targeting nomads, and they're like, oh, a person who can live anywhere will come to my new city. But the person who can live anywhere could be in Tokyo or Austin or Bali or whatever. Like, those people are really hard to compete for. Our focus with Alpha is much more on building for locals. And it's like, to what degree is like currency an actual problem that they would want us to put effort into fixing? You know, I mean, it depends on the country.
Yeah.
But they're not coming at it philosophically. They just want to live.
Yeah, no, I understood. And I guess, I mean, I mentioned philosophically in the sense that I think this question does butt up against, development studies and like, what does it mean for a country to come in, for a group to come in and take sovereignty over a country? Oh, in the vast majority of cases, historically, that has meant issuing a currency. And that currency then is required to pay your taxes. And there's different ways of analyzing this. You've got charterism and different ways of looking at it. But basically, you have to pay us, so you have to get it. And so it like makes the sort of virtuous cycle of money come into being. And I have a lot of criticism of that, don't get me wrong. But I wonder, you know, when you're using something like stablecoins, are you really sovereign, or are you downstream of the United States? Or is there other ways of looking at it?
I mean, I'm a human who lives on Earth. And so in many ways, I'm downstream of the United States. Yeah. So, you know, I don't believe that sovereignty is not being downstream of the United States. Like, the United States has plenty to worry about and plenty of problems and plenty of priorities. I think of this stuff as like pragmatic. Like, I don't know that stablecoins are the way, like, long term, but what an incredible bridge from where we were to where we're going. And like, you know, again, like, charter cities are not explicitly not sovereign, not trying to be sovereign. You know, like, if I started like my like Libertopia, like sovereign city state, and people wanted to use USDC, I mean, go for it, right? Like, the important thing is that we like support better alternatives, and then people are going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously you're familiar with the sovereign individual and these kind of works that have been exploring this for a long time. And certainly that book left a big impression on me.
It was great.
Back in, 1997? And it's funny, they mentioned New Zealand quite a lot in that book for some reason. But there's this kind of history of thought of sovereignty, of exit, perhaps connected with neoliberal thought. And I just wonder... And I hope we can talk about this. There has been some criticisms of this general approach, and it's strange because I think both you and me are looking at this and we're trying to build stuff. You know, I'm really interested in Bitcoin, passionate about freedom. Feeling like, look, there is a better way to do things that we should be talking about. But there have been criticisms, and I'm just interested to run these past you and kind of get your thoughts, because I was quite surprised. I watched an interview with Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor that called yourself, Peter Thiel, and others by name as participating in a kind of end times fascism, that somehow, you know, we're going to exit the consequences of what we've done. And I mean, look,
there's
some
schizophrenic blogger who like says that like I am like taking over the US and the UK, the UK with like free ports and the US with like freedom cities, which like aren't even a thing and are going to be like 99.99% the same US laws as the rest of the country. If like, and so it's just retarded, but you know.
Yeah. Well, in particular,
whatever entertains Naomi Klein, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair though, because I mean, I'm trying to build bridges with people, and I'm trying to communicate that there is a better way, and obviously the importance of freedom. And having been through the COVID era myself in a country that really didn't do it in a very good way, I'm quite sensitive to questions of freedom. And I mean, she does say that it is this fantasy of exit, that rich people should be able to exit from nation states, regulations, and especially taxes. It is a fantasy that has been brewing on the libertarian tech right for the last few decades. And I mean, you've talked about how you're still using law from other countries,
bonkers,
and franchising the law. Yeah. So
the
you don't agree
for
with
two
that.
Reasons. One, okay. Most of my attention is on building an Africa for Africans. So that just throws the entire thing out. It's true that Peter Thiel is an investor who's helping me build these new zones with better regulations and water and roads and houses for Africans. But like, that's what I'm doing. And then, and the other thing is like, has she never heard of the Bahamas? Does she not know like what the U.S. expatriation tax law is? It's completely legal to change what country you live in. Like, and if it wasn't, people would, you know, be swimming like to get to other places. And there exist many tax havens. There's places where a rich person can move and pay no taxes. There have been forever, and I'm sure there will be forever. And like, so it's kind of like, what does that have to do with us? And I get that there is like a little bit of connection. I do like philosophically feel like, yeah, people should be empowered as like customers to like choose where they want to live and like look at the different packages of what will I pay and what will I get. And like, one of my things is trying to get people to think more like customers. I think that all this stuff gets wrapped up when you talk about a state, you know, where people are like, oh, they're passing this law that my political enemies like, that I feel like is like against me, like all this, and like morals and ethics and like philosophy and all of this that I think can like get in the way of pragmatically improving things. And like, it sounds like she's against the idea that some people might have other options and take them up on it, which sounds like a typical leftist thing to be like concerned about, but it's, you know, I think that there's probably a fear underlying this, which is like, what if the people who actually make stuff leave? Like, and they probably think of it as like the rich people who have like wrongfully captured all this value or whatever. But it's like, no, like whatever, Jeff Bezos starting Amazon or something. And they're probably scared of that. And they should be, because like countries are, you know, the U.S. is going downhill and most countries do a really crappy job. And I think that we can outcompete them. But that's great. Making something better that is like the foundation of society that gets people to like move there is amazing for humanity. I mean, look at the U.S. It's how we came to exist. What does she think about all the people who fled Europe for the U.S.? About like the source of the entire population of the U.S. That was damn.
Yeah.
They just probably didn't like the taxes back there. How dare they flee?
Yeah. Oh, no, I understand. And I think her critiques struck me a little bit, though, because I'm like, hey, like, you know, I'm trying to just build bridges here with different people. And I was like, hey, you know, are you including me in that? Because I'm one of these guys who left New Zealand, which is going through a major recession. The shit's hit the fan. You know, it's not so right. I'm doing the arbitrage where I'm like, I'm living in Japan now. You know, and we're taking advantage of the opportunities that are given to us.
How dare you?
Yeah, you know. And
so ungrateful to the country of your birth.
And this
I
is interesting.
I hope you pay them some voluntary taxes, you know.
Yeah, some tribute. But what this butts up against, though, is if we've got a city that is treating people, you know, it's a customer relationship, right? It maybe comes up against the question of what is national identity and what is, is your birthright and these kinds of questions. And they become kind of social questions. And this is the basis of patriotism. This is the basis of national identity. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on how that's evolving. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's much harder for us. And that's like a downside, right? Is, you know, we don't have some strong ethno-religious geographic identities to draw from, you know, to be social glue. You know, if you're, you know, obviously when we're building in Africa for Africans, you do. But, you know, if we're talking about later, you know, starting a sovereign city state that attracts people from all over the world, and then you don't have that and you have to form like a new identity around this like new thing that you've created in the same way that a new company does, except much more intensely because it's like your state and your homeland. So I think that like we're just going to have less of that glue, and that, but if the place is strong and attractive, it's going to develop its own culture and people have some identity. But I would kind of expect, like, if you're thinking more as a consumer, then you're not going to have a strong. I mean, I have some identity because I finally bought a Tesla
Apple
after like 10 years.
Yeah,
exactly. I don't get me started on how my dad started sending me the first Macs. He would get one and he'd get the new one and send me the old one. So I've been using them since the 80s. But yes, I am. You know, so there's some, but it's not as strong, I think, for most people in most countries as their national identity.
One way of pitching this is I think the people who I think about this, people like you and me, who are looking at what we can do, how we can get out. I mean, we are a certain strata, and there is also a huge amount of people, you know, I was back in New Zealand recently, and I mean, there are a huge amount of people who are just sort of doing what they've always done, and it kind of implies that they're going to just keep doing that. They're on the single flag, you know, they're in the country of birth doing the thing they've always done. And that there's other people now who have, increasingly this is trickling down to enable people even of more humble means to be able to leave and go and do other stuff. And so maybe there's almost like a different approach where people can move to Dubai and not pay the same taxes, or they can stay behind and pay 35%, 40% taxes. And that maybe that's not for everyone though. You know, maybe some people are like, well, look, I'm just happy to do what I've always done, right?
I mean, I think, yeah, for sure. I mean, people are different, and, you know, I think, like, look, like, products have different prices. Like, a Tesla doesn't cost the same as a Lambo, and a Tesla also doesn't cost the same as, like, a Kia. They're different price points where people can choose what they want. And I think that, you know, again, if you think about it as a business, like, I would expect that, like, different charter city projects would, like, make different choices. And some will charge more and offer more, and some will charge less and offer less, just like any other product, and then consumers will decide, look at the options and decide what they like.
And
I think, like, I expect our taxes to be lower than other places, because, like, you know, there's the old startup saying is, like, to make a startup work, you have to either be 10 times cheaper or 10 times better. And, like, if we're trying to compete, we have the disadvantage of not having economies of scale and not being an incumbent. And so I want to make it better and cheaper. And I think if, you know, anybody who's looked closely at how governments spend money, you know, will understand that it's actually probably possible to do, like, a lot more with a lot less. But, you know, I'm just talking about, like, we have a new product, and so we're going to want to make it cheaper. But that's different than being like, nobody should ever, I don't know, pay taxes. I mean, I guess I want to move that, you know, once you've, like, chosen, like, you have where to go, like, take that from some kind of, like, profound moral question about who has the right to tax me and how, and just be like, you're getting stuff and you're getting charged for it, and here's how, so pick what you want.
Yeah, and I mean, we're already seeing this play out. I mean, the phrase user pays is quite common, even in New Zealand, which is historically a very nanny state. You know, everything was done through the government. Now You want to do some process, you want to get your license renewed, I mean, you have to pay, user pays. And there's aspects that are not like that, but it's kind of interesting that this lexicon has developed over the last 30, 40 years of neoliberalism. And even here in Japan, which is a major nanny state, I still have to pay for things out of pocket that I want through the government. And it's interesting, right, that this has slowly creeped in. And it sort of, I mean, what's the end state of that?
Well, I wasn't familiar with this. Wow, I really like user pays. That's great. Because, like, bundling is such an issue. And, like, when you bundle the budgets and government departments for, like, a massive number of different things into one economic unit. I mean, I worked at Google from 2004. And, you know, even at that size, and of course became much more of a problem over the years, the challenges of, like, the internal markets, like, decision making, who gets what compute resources, like, how do you allocate budget when together all of these different groups are forming your Google search engine and ads, and, like, it's not easy to say, like, what percentage of the value comes from which, right? It's really, really hard, even in something the size of a large corporation, like, let alone a government. And so the more you can, like, unbundle and have there be, like, you know, the incentives of having use fees so that people don't overuse services, and just, like, tying the value created by that department, like, more closely to their revenues, I think is amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, there's been a bit of work on this. There was an economist, Eleanor Ostrom, who I think developed concepts around, like, institutional economics and transaction cost economics, which kind of cover some of this stuff. And I think some of that thinking has begun to feed into government approaches. And the other comment I would make, Patri, is New Zealand is a small country, smaller, 5-6 million people. And it's kind of interesting. I was just back recently and we had a
a lot bigger than Google.
Yeah, well, but We launched a Bitcoin Policy Institute, and I'm a committee member there. And I mean, we had like MPs and ministers turn up to the event, and it was like you couldn't do that in the US with like a couple of guys like organizing an event, you know, on a very with limited resources. And so with smaller economies, smaller projects like that, you can actually just talk to the boss. You can get things done. And I think this maybe speaks to your decentralization and kind of maybe smaller states. In the US, you know, how do you get anything done when there's like 50 layers of bullshit to get through? And I mean, there is scales of economy, but it's also this slow moving beast where a place like New Zealand, Luxembourg, Switzerland, you know, slightly smaller countries, and even smaller than that, you get into some of these micro states, they can do stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, we mainly, you know, what we see is that it's much easier, much quicker to work with smaller countries. It can still be frustrating. You know, I think like to me, 5-6 million is like starting to get like too big in terms of like what I've seen, like working with democracies. At the same time, the larger countries are larger markets. You know, if you look at a place like, you know, like Angola, for example, with like 40 million people, there is a lot more opportunity there. And so we're kind of working on both, just understanding that the larger countries are like riskier and like slower, but then potentially a bigger payoff. But yeah, it's funny here that you think that way. Cause like for my orientation these days, I'm like, man, if I could start something that was 5 million people, like that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And when I'm working with a country of 5 million people, to me, that's already like starting to get big.
Yeah, understood. Well, look, man, it's really interesting to talk about all of these ideas. And when it comes to Pronomos, what's next for you? What are you excited about for the fund?
Yeah, so I mean, we've wrapped up our 5-year investment period earlier this year, and my focus is mainly on helping our company Alpha Cities raise the money to build out a bunch of cities for a bunch of Africans all across Africa, and then you know, if that goes well, I would probably raise a second fund.
Yeah, what part have you spent much time in Africa? What part do you enjoy?
So my business partner is the CEO of that business. You know, I'm focused more on fundraising and content and things like that. So he does the travel. I expect to get out there next year. We're mainly working with former Portuguese countries that speak Portuguese, because I had a good connection there to get in with them. And yeah, really excited to visit some of those places next year. Other stuff we'll have, you know, there's socials for Pronomos at Pronomos VC on Twitter, and there's going to be a lot more. I've got a bunch of like short like fact type videos, and we're working a lot of content about what we've learned over these 5 years. Things like build for locals, not for nomads, and a lot of stuff. A lot of things like that, like the amount of founder experience that's required to do this. I mean, this stuff is hard. So, gonna be a lot of stuff coming out in the coming months.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, look, man, thanks for sharing that and telling us a bit about what you're doing there. I guess there's just one more thing. I just having a look on my list here that I don't know if we fully covered, and if it's okay to come back to it. I just had here the idea of the moral substrate of a place, and I think this might have been something you talked about in one of your videos, but the unifying idea of a city beyond just lower taxes, whether it's religion, ethnic identity, these kinds of things, when you're building for locals, how does that fit into it? Is it about their place and their people, or is there something else that can feed into that?
That's an interesting question. You know, because like we're not going to come in proselytizing about freedom. You know, that's not what anyone asked for. We're gonna build stuff that makes their lives better, and I think that like over time, as it's working, I think this like will affect the moral substrate. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, people who spent 10 years in Hong Kong versus people who spent 10 years in Beijing probably have pretty different ideas about the benefits of freedom, for example. You know, but we want to do this by doing it, by having them see the benefits, see the factories get built, you know, see the jobs come, move up the economic ladder. And then when someone wants to know, like, why do things work here? Well, you know, now it's a great time for maybe a smidge of proselytizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood. All right, man. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.